Thank you. What a really interesting set of papers. I'm struck by a kind of narrative from Adrian's through Ron's to Sarah's, in which political authority is initially framed as awe-inspiring through terrorizing to loving consolation. Okay, so I find this the common approach that you all take to the political history of revolutionary and post-revolutionary France, that emotional motivations and rhetoric are key to understanding this history, especially welcome having just finished teaching a course that covers the French Revolution to undergraduates. As I imagine some of you have experienced, students are completely certain that ideas play an overwhelming role in the revolution, and moving them on to a more complex reading that might include, for example, emotions or economic or other factors is a persistent challenge. I should add that given our current political environment, there are some resonances as well. The role of popular emotions in politics has been the focus of histories, especially of the revolution, for a long time. As Sophia Rosenfeld noted recently, however, until recently, agency was taken off the table as discourse was given the power to determine circumstances, opinion, and behavior. However, since William Reddy's 2001 Navigation of Feeling introduced this idea of emotional regimes and in a way set the methodological agenda for the history of emotions, the study of emotions in France has become a rich and really creative field of inquiry. Thus, if earlier scholarship on popular emotions tended to oversimplify the importance, for example, of crowd passions or fear, which, as David Andrus recently noted, carries the suggestion that historical actors could not help themselves, contemporary historians, these three included, now approach the history with a more nuanced understanding of the interaction between contexts and individuals in shaping emotional responses to political circumstances. In Adrian O'Connor's paper, we see one such nuanced analysis as political actors are shown marshaling their emotional resources in order to brace themselves against fear rather than allowing themselves, in a way, to be driven by it. Thus, it's the embrace of fraternity that took center stage in the politically fraught summer of 92 when Deputy Lamourette proposed that he and his colleagues in the Legislative Assembly seal their oath of eternal fraternity with a sincere embrace. Lamourette's kiss was to be a means of overcoming, or at least, I don't know if I want to use that word. I'll leave it and I'll come back to it. Overcoming internal divisions and fortifying themselves to face all means of foreign threat. In Adrian's account, fraternity emerges not only as a rhetoric of unity, political unity in this case, but in fact the necessary ingredient for the management of disunity, a necessary condition for debate, as you put it. Taken this way, the notion of fraternity becomes a fundamental building block to the establishment of a new form of civil society, one that is conducive to what Adrian refers to as collective self-governance among people of honest intentions. And as we heard, he then uses this redefined function of fraternity as a tool to analyze the interpersonal and institutional function rather than the performative one that fraternity played in revolutionary politics. So as a historian myself of early 19th century France, I find this approach really suggestive for a couple of reasons. First of all, this depiction of fraternity as a process, if you will, I think, Adrian, you used the term instrument, rather than an outcome, in a way presages, and in important ways, the views of 19th century critics of egoism and capitalism and individualism, especially in the economic realm. Adrian's discussion of the revolutionary proposals to remedy poverty, for example, proposals that you suggest radically altered thinking about the origins of poverty and the role of the stricken in civil society, provides an important precedent for 19th century sociological discussions of poverty and social dislocation. This line of reasoning is directly relevant, I think, also to historians' current interest in the political and cultural means French people deployed to reestablish community and stability in post-revolutionary France. And along these lines, one question I would like to hear, or a topic I'd like to hear more about in our discussion, is the extent to which any kind of religious language came into these discussions of fraternity. I'm struck in particular by the idea of regeneration, which in the Romantic era anyway was this really important and deeply Christian idea, but one which resonated throughout both conservative and left-leaning rhetoric. Now, Ron Schechter's paper, Terror and Reassurance in the Year 2, approaches the role of emotions in the French Revolution from a different perspective, asking a deceptively simple question: what was the appeal of the word terror in the 18th century? And arguing persuasively that the word meant something positive to the people who used it, quite contrary to our contemporary affective climate, I would add. In Ron's analysis, the awe-inspiring grandeur of religious and political institutions of the old regime remain important cultural influences on the revolutionaries. The emotional power of the patriarch of whatever sort to both terrify and protect his dependents is evoked, I think, especially. Ron's papers further suggest that giving voice to terror-inspiring utterances gave revolutionaries a kind of reassurance and even courage against forces that, in turn, they sought to to combat. Stepping back from the specific historical moment, well, actually, I really have two questions. The first question is, to what extent could we see the use of terror as a way of asserting a kind of political legitimacy? It seemed to me that there were moments in which they were convincing themselves of their right to make war or survey the society or what have you. But more generally, I'm struck by the transformation of the idea of terror. In the uses that Ron quotes here, we can see important continuities to the power dynamics of the old regime, in which authority structures instilled terror, but admiration and a certain kind of comfort in subordinates. In our world, that sensation of terror has lost, the sensation of terror has lost those other associations and is arguably really only used to connote personal fear or maybe societal fear of attack. So a question I have for you is, when you note that you suppose that they weren't proposing a radically new worldview, when do you think what we might perceive as the definition or meaning of terror changed? In other words, how did the lived experience of the terror, capital T, maybe work to make the transition away from a kind of frightening but also edifying notion to something that really doesn't have that kind of positive connotation? Sarah Horowitz's paper takes the historical investigation of emotions in a really different direction. And although I'm really curious about the internal dynamics of the household, the crux of Sarah's argument revolves more around the divergent views of the murder victim, the Duchesse. Was she a devoted mother and wife, spurned by her debauched husband and replaced by the social climber governess Henriette de Nuzy? Or was she a cold, distant, perhaps abusive mother, and he a protective family man? It's the political implications of these two accounts of the murder, and more particularly the affective significance of the narratives constructed for the reading public, that are at stake for the monarchy and its critics. In the early 19th century, whether under the restored Bourbons or the Orleanist July monarchy, the authority and legitimacy of the institution and of the weakened nobility were ever-present concerns for the regime. And as Sarah notes, the murder of the Duchesse was an example of elites behaving very, very badly. The shadow that bad behavior cast was long, and it implicated Louis-Philippe and royal authority, and the critical instrument to combat this stain, Sarah shows us, was the narrative of the wrong Duchesse's selfless mother. The political valence of the emotions evoked by this murder is radically different from those discussed by our first two speakers. Unlike, for example, the revolutionaries that Adrian discussed earlier, love in this narrative appears as a crucial element in reinforcing, rather than flattening, notions of natural hierarchy. And it certainly doesn't appear as a bond that could undergird egalitarian political relations. Thus, the Duchesse's devotion to her children, much quoted in the press accounts of her murder, suggests the paternal caretaking of the nobility toward their people. While this depiction implicitly refutes the decadence of her husband, it also, with perhaps a longer viewpoint, counters the libelle of the 18th century that so tarnished the reputation of the monarchy and especially royal women. I find this really rich and suggestive material that intersects very interestingly with work done on royalty and gender and mothering by Joby Margadant, for example, but going in new and interesting directions with regard to the engagement of the monarchy in the reinforcement of its own legitimacy through these narratives. So I have a couple of questions. One is regards this dichotomy you draw in your paper between egalitarian uses of sentimental narratives and this more hierarchy-reinforcing one. It seems to me that the period is, on all sides, is full of these organic invocations of familial bonds, of the affective importance of love in tying the society together. And though I clearly see that, I'm persuaded by your argument that this is a conservative monarchist agenda, I wonder if you, in the larger work, if you might be addressing the ways in which the monarchy itself is drawing on a much broader political vocabulary during this period. And you've talked a bit about the Mariolatry of the era, and that seems very resonant to me as well. The other thing I wanted to mention is, I'm reading my notes in a bad way, I'm done. Thank you. Do any of you want to answer questions raised in the comment, or should we just open up to the audience? It's up to you guys. Audience? Questions? Oh, there are questions.
It's to me.
Ready?
Here I go.
Me as well.
Yes. Well, actually, I just wanted to reinforce your question. So I'm really interested in how and when and why the connotations of terror changed. And, you know, with Robespierre's execution, you know, or later, what happened? I'm really interested in that. And also, I just share your questions about the connections with the bad mother, Marie Antoinette, and this is clearly the reverse. But also, I just want to add yet another layer to this, is this was a bourgeois monarchy and a good mother, and to what extent was kind of the appropriation of bourgeois maternalism playing into the aristocrat order?
So when does the meaning of terror change? When does terror become a pejorative? It happens very, very quickly after the fall of Robespierre. That is, it's not the only reason that terror has negative connotations to us, but it's probably the biggest one. That the experience of what would come to be called the terror as a period in French history, and more to the point, the interpretation of what happened during that period was, I think, precisely what gave terror the negative connotations that it has today. Now, my story ends really with the period of the terror, and I think, you know, lots of people have talked about the history of terrorism or the history of the idea or the concept of terror after the revolution. So I think it's hard for me to go any further in this study than 1794, but I very much doubt that anyone in the 19th century, you know, seriously praised any of the rulers as being the terror of their enemies. You know, I think that expression probably that expression probably pretty much disappeared. So I think that there's, in a way, a very simple answer to this question. It's really when the term terrorism was coined, which was really within weeks of the execution of Robespierre, you know, probably August of 1794, I think we can date it pretty precisely. So that would be my answer.
Do you want to address what you're
talking about? I'm totally fascinated by the figure of the bad mother because except for these mentions in sort of what Deluzzi says, everyone takes her as this like this perfect mother. There's some sort of stuff about, well, she was maybe too obsessed with her husband and so wasn't concentrating on her kids. And actually, she's a terrible mother. I mean, the kind of archival record is just like tragic. And I think that there's this sort of, in a way, this very interesting, on both the kind of opponents of the regime and then its supporters, that the abusive mother is taboo in certain respects, right? That's this kind of thing that is just so unimaginable. And with respect to the kind of question of bourgeois morality, I think that one of the things that's really fascinating, again, from the archival record, and we only have her side, so we have her letters, and then there's sort of some letters from the Duke to Deluzzi and from the children to Deluzzi, is that the kind of, you can sort of see this kind of, he has a sort of aristocratic notion of marriage as, right, like we're going to have this sort of social facade, and it's about the alliance between families, and we'll just sort of do what we want. And she has this kind of, you know, what we would consider intensely bourgeois notion of, like, we must be this sort of, like, you know, kind of bonded couple. But his is actually much more individualistic, right? So his is sort of, like, kind of, you know, you can see in her letters him voicing in some letters, I want to be with the people I want to be with. And she's saying, this is sort of duty, and you owe this to me as part of your duty. And I think that is a kind of very complicated element to this relationship between what we usually think about the relationship between sentiment and status.
Ron, for Adriana, you know what? What I was thinking of as I was listening to you, Adrian, was Hannah Arendt's argument in On Revolution about the French revolutionaries' obsession, as she conceives it, with the passion of compassion. And what you really have done is put a nice institutional and ideological kind of scaffolding on that rather abstract interpretation she gives. But what she does insist on is how distinctly French it is. And I'm thinking of Gareth Stedman Jones' recent work on the poor relief proposals of Condorcet and of Tom Paine. In other words, it was both a French and an Anglo sort of impulse. And I'm wondering, you know, is it your contention that this sentimental, this alliance between sentiment and poor relief was a distinctly French thing or not? For Ron, my question has to do with criminal punishment, actually. Because I'm trying to, as I'm following you along, it's a fascinating argument and persuasive in many ways to me. But I'm thinking of the capital T terror and what work it is doing as opposed to the lower T terror. And it seems to me that one of the distinctive things the capital T terror is doing is punishing criminals. Okay, with criminals defined in all kinds of ways here. And the question that raises is, you know, to what extent was the lower T terror a word associated with the actual practice of punishing criminals under the old regime? And is that slice of your argument something that you'd want to pull out, given the institutional role that terror then assumes in the year 3 and 4?
We're standing with chronology. I'll go first. Thank you. That's a great tie back to Arendt. This obsession with compassion, I think, is the idea of institutionalizing that concern, right? Finding the ways in which revolutionaries sought to ground that in practice and saw this as something that needed institutional form where compassion was not necessarily naturally occurring or naturally sustaining or self-sustaining is very much part of the project. I wouldn't think, at least I'm not disposed to think of it as uniquely French. I couldn't speak in any depth to British or English examples, although at least not of the specifics of poor relief. But certainly the anxieties that are leading to this sort of dynamic within the revolution, they're transatlantic in cases. They're certainly emerging in the arguments between Smith and Condorcet, or Smith and Rousseau, that I don't see these as uniquely French. If anything, perhaps they are more fully embedded in the context of the rise of commercial society and anxieties related to that. Again, I very in passing mentioned Kant, who has some of these anxieties. It may be in a sense that that because the revolutionaries are inheriting something of a kind of failed sociopolitical regime, they're forced to think of these in institutional terms more immediately. I was struck by Naomi's point about post-revolutionary return to some of these concerns. And there's an inheritance that comes with the revolution. It strikes me that the post-revolution, the restoration monarchy, not only has people who doubt its legitimacy, but it can no longer present itself as inevitable, right, as a naturally occurring phenomenon. I think the same is true for a lot of social relations, whether they're hierarchical or corporatist or whatever they might be, that the language of the revolution is taking the model of both familial and elective associations, whether it's Freemasons or other groups, and trying to find the elective associations and make them into the sort of things that could sort of provide foundation for a body politic, to make them scalable, to use the language of our day rather than theirs. And I don't think that was necessarily a uniquely revolutionary problem. If anything, maybe it was faced under more pressing economic and political circumstances for a brief period that focused attention on it. But I wouldn't make any claim to exclusivity for the French on that.
And I would say that, yes, absolutely. Part of one of the biggest parts of the appeal of terror speech in the year two was precisely the association of terror with punishment. And there are, I have a chapter on this in my book about the terror of the law or the terror of the laws. 18th century writers on punishment, and not just the French, were very consistent about using the term terror to describe the effect of the effect of punishment, and especially conspicuous punishment, public punishment, and public executions and so on. But not only executions. It's, what's interesting is that even in the debate about the death penalty, Beccaria will write that he'll write against the death penalty, but his argument is that it's insufficiently terrifying. It doesn't that the terror goes without saying. Everybody agrees that the law must inspire terror and that punishment must inspire terror. The disagreement is on what kinds of punishment will inspire the most terror. And they all use the word. They all use the word terror. So yes, without a doubt, and also in the early part of the revolution, as there are, you know, that debate about capital punishment comes up again, and in many different contexts in the speech of the revolutionaries during the early part of the revolution, terror is associated with punishment. It's associated with justice, and that is really a big part of the appeal. No. It doesn't, because I mean the terror is not. Does the word terror come up in the torture? You know, that's a really good question. I'm not remembering that right now. I think it does, but I don't want to say for sure because I could be wrong about that.
How it is that the regime in the July monarchy could what they thought they were gaining by the by the revelation of all these details concerning the affair. And I say the reason I ask that this is partly I've been spending some time lately reading Victor Hugo's Choses Vues, And he was a member of the Chamber of Peers and was privy to what was the hearings that were held and what was going on. But there are dozens of pages in his just stuff that he'd collected and copied down about the affair. And one of the things they include is excerpts from even Orleanist journals talking about this affair as revealing the corruption of the regime. And so it would seem to me that any other strategy beside greater publicity would have been wise.
It's a great question, and I would love to know what was in the minds of these people. So I think that some of it has to do actually with the kind of actually like sort of effective closeness of Pacquier, for instance, to the Duchess. He was actually a witness at the wedding. I think that, you know, the king and his sister, Adelaide, are very, very close to the Duchess. And I think there's some sort of feeling of this kind of deep sorrow. I also think that there's enormous outrage about did the authorities allow the Duke to take poison? Did they give him the poison? There's even this theory, and like someone's trying to, you know, DNA test descendants, that he like sort of went to Latin America, you know, sort of escaped. And so I think that they feel this need for transparency, partly because of this issue of not having arrested him, and essentially, it's basically a guard wasn't watching him when he went into his bathroom. I think that's partly it. I also think that there's this very interesting, so I'm obviously interested in scandals, and the French state, of course, has this long history, and you see it in the Restoration and the Third Republic, of just trying to bury this stuff. But it's really hard when there's dead bodies. And it's really, you know, sort of the Duchess's wounded body is, I think, sort of makes that in some ways very difficult. And I think it was also trying to sort of say, look, the Duke, you can't save him, right? I mean, there's kind of no hope. But maybe you can get something from the Duchess as this sort of object of sympathy in a kind of climate when there's not a lot of sympathy for the aristocracy.
Yeah, my question goes to Sarah as well. My name is Pascal Fergus, and I have worked recently a little bit on family structures in the ancien regime aristocracy. This case really strikes me because it's so different. Because what you described as conservative would, of course, from the ancien regime perspective, be super modern Rousseau-esque conception of family. In which, of course, there's also clearly a gender hierarchy. There's only a very brief period, maybe in the revolutionary era, where that is this hierarchy between man and woman is challenged, but only also for only by a few people. I think this is a very interesting thing because if this is conservatism, it's a very modern version of conservatism, and I think that's exactly what makes it interesting because the Duke in this case is like this old conservatism which people don't like. So I think that plays very much in your the way you explained it, that this is a strategy to save anything that is possible by publishing everything this woman writes, because she might gain some sympathy by a broader public by presenting a very popular version of conservatism, maybe something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. And so one of the things that I've been so struck by in kind of reading accounts of the affair is that there's no escaping sentiment and emotionality as the kind of discussion of the way in which political questions are framed, right? That sort of both the opposition and, you know, what I presented here, they sort of only present their points as, you know, something went wrong emotionally in the household. And I think that in a way shows this kind of power of emotions in this period, right, that sort of they may kind of reaffirm hierarchy or they may challenge it, but that's the way in which you have to frame certain political discussions.
This panel was fascinating. I have a question for Ronald. I really liked your approach of this longer durée history of terror, and to show how the revolution really inherits an older notion of terror. And you actually said that revolution didn't bring a new worldview when it comes to the notion of terror. But I was wondering, I was wondering whether you could enlighten a little more the aspect, the temporal aspect of terror, because all your words or notions you were presenting as well, hope, confidence, courage, consolation, have an aspect of building on a past experience and then also approaching the future or the I was thinking of what could be another term for terror that was used in the Ancien Régime, and if you compare it maybe to grandeur, that was used very much under Louis XIV and was very much based on a Roman and Athenian model, for example, and was also based on past achievements of the great king. And here in terror you have this aspect of an ex post approach to law, that crime or the revolutionary ideas or somebody acted against the revolutionary ideas or what have you. So it's an ex post approach, but there's also this ex ante approach to law, to terrify in order to avoid that this would be happening in the future. And I wonder if that is not new in the approach to law.
So what's the new part?
There is a much stronger notion to focus on the future.
I don't know. I think that, you know, with terror as deterrent, and deterrent does come from the same root, right? It's literally to terrify. It's terrifying away from something. But with terror as deterrent, and I agree that it does have a special temporal aspect to it. But I would focus more on the continuity. I would say that the terror, that old regime terror of punishment, right, or the terror of the laws, is very much future oriented, right? The idea being that if you violate the laws, you will suffer, right? And there are exemplary punishments, right, that you can view publicly or that you can hear about or read about that will focus the mind, right? That will prevent you from carrying out those acts. But so I would say that yes, it has an interesting temporal aspect to it, but I would focus more on the continuity there.
We have time for one more question. Two more.
Two more. So Paul Hanson, I couldn't help but thinking, Adrian, as I listened to your recounting of the kiss of Lamorette, that perhaps we could look forward to a kiss of Paul Ryan in the coming months. that thought perished quickly. For Ronald, I found your paper really fascinating in a lot of different ways. I think when you responded, you know, to Naomi's comment about, you know, when does terror take on a more negative, when do we lose this, any sense of reassurance or consolation is going with it. It did occur to me that, you know, I think for the for the revolutionaries of the 20th century, terror still held a certain positive meaning. It was not as if they felt they were doing something horrible in Russia or in China when they carried out terror against their opponents. You framed your early remarks between September and 9 Thermidor in looking for incidences of reference to terror in the Archive Parlementaire. And my question now is one that you probably won't be able to answer, but maybe Meta can. I mean, given the work that Meta Hurt has been doing about the fact that terror doesn't just disappear after 9 Thermidor, I'm wondering if the language disappears as well, or if we would find, if we looked or if you looked in the archive for the year or so after 9 Thermidor, that terror continues to come up in parliamentary discourse.
So I would say, first of all, I would just have to defer to any historian of the Bolshevik Revolution, for example. Did terror have positive connotations? Did the Russian word for terror have positive connotations? That's way outside of my area of expertise, and that's why I have to be very careful about saying that, you know, the negative connotations associated with terror came out with Thermidor. But as far as the your next question is concerned, I certainly haven't looked as carefully into the last volumes of the Archive Parlementaire, which really, for those of you who know the Archive Parlementaire, only cover a few months, really, of the end of 1794, and I think maybe the very beginning of 1795. But, you know, my impressionistic look at it suggests that there were very, very few, if any, positive invocations of terror after the 9th of Thermidor. So I do think that at least for the revolutionaries, there's a fairly rapid and dramatic change in terror speech at the end of the terror.
Absolutely.
Which isn't at all to say, by the way, that everything was fine and peaceful after Thermidor and everybody was happy and went out and danced as they were supposed to.
Embraced each other.
Like revolutionary justice and things like that. But I actually have a question for Sarah, and this might be completely ignorant because I really know so little about this period. What I was wondering was the references to this the Duchess having been a bad mother. It just brought all these memories of the trial of Marie Antoinette, and it's sort of to some extent being a taboo subject as well. But I guess what I was wondering was, to what degree is murder in the family something that is very uncomfortable for the Orléans? and also the sort of the collapse of the family in general, and how that is related to state power, to government power. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So I think it is very uncomfortable. I mean, I think this is sort of gets to John's earlier question. Like, they don't have a choice, right? Sort of when you have two dead bodies, you sort of, right? If you're the state, you have to do something with it. So I think it is this tale of domestic dysfunction, I think, is really uncomfortable. I think it's also in some ways very uncomfortable for the opposition, which on the one hand they exploited and sort of, or maybe exploit isn't the right word, but they sort of talk about how horrible the Duke is. If only relationships were more egalitarian, then we'd have more love in society and we'd be sort of like, there'd be, you know, kind of more like a sort of positive feeling throughout society, which gets to your point. So I think that it's not comfortable for them either, And again, they sort of tend to recast it as this very black and white story, whereas, you know, the sort of archival record is so much more complicated, and you just end up sort of hating everyone. and so I think it is this the kind of the way in which femininity, you know, the kind of loving mother becomes this one stable constant in the affair on either the right or the left.
Thank you.